Welcome, everybody, to the latest in our podcast series. Today, I'm joined by Brendan, who's just written, I think, an excellent paper, Brendan, titled, Will the Green Energy Transition Survive Mr. Trump? Here we are with wildfires blazing in California, and I was just reading over the weekend that we have in 2024 breached that kind of critical threshold of 1.5 degrees. Is it already too late? I mean, have we already seen people giving up on what really needs to be done?
Yeah, so I think really the situation in Los Angeles and in the U.S. is pretty bad. What's happening with the wildfires, etc. It's a shame. It's pretty bad. And this is what I talk about in this paper. There are also positive trends in the energy transition. We are doing something about it. We're not doing enough. That's pretty clear, particularly in terms of investment and other things. So yes, we're not doing enough, but it wouldn't be true that we're not doing anything against it.
And I guess one could argue that some of these headlines about the 1.5 degree being breached and these wildfires, maybe that again is a sharp reminder that we really need to progress on the commitments that have been laid out up until now.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there is a sense really that physical risks, so the climate change materializing in fires, droughts, heat waves, etc. This is materializing quicker than had been anticipated. And that should prompt us to action, indeed. Also, something that I want to mention is how precise actually were the models of physical
models climate. Precise, really?
Yes. If you go back to the 80s with the climate models, predicting what's going to happen in terms of the climate, the temperature anomaly, and all those things. Well, it turns out that they were spot on. So we've known about the problem for a long time, and now it's really time to do something about it.
Well, doing something about it, is that going to be helped by a new president who we know has been very vocal about his skepticism and cynicism around climate and climate policies? I mean, one of the catch lines has been drill, baby, drill. Now, this is a president who's just won the popular vote. So the people of America voted for him and his policies. So what does that tell us? Does it tell us that actually America in aggregate has moved away from the notion of greening the planet and America?
Yeah, so I think it's a perfectly valid question, of course. Donald Trump hasn't made it a secret that he's a climate skeptic. He doesn't really believe in human-induced climate change. So, of course, there's a question here. What's going to happen? What's the future of the energy transition? That's what we talk about in this topical paper. And essentially, the point I make is, when you think about addressing climate change, there are basically two different channels to which this can be done. There's the policy, the climate policy channel, and also the economic channel. So on the climate policy channel, yes, in the U.S., it looks we're going in reverse. President Trump is unlikely to push for additional climate policies, for a strengthening of those policies. But I also think that he's unlikely to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act. So just as a reminder, this is this big scheme in the U.S., which is incentivizing investing in clean technologies, developing new sources of energy.
And frankly, it's helped a lot of the red states. I mean, that's perhaps been a surprising thing under the Biden proposals and actually policies themselves.
Yes, exactly. And that's, I think, the main reason why the repealing of this Inflation Reduction Act is pretty unlikely, because precisely has benefited Republican states. And actually, it's very interesting because it's also acting as a source of growth. Studies by the International Energy Agency on those questions, and it starts to show up in the real GDP numbers. So, clean energy is also bringing growth, and this is, the bridge to this economic argument that actually addressing climate change, changing the ways we produce energy, is actually starting to make a lot of economic sense as well, and that's what I want to emphasize.
So the drill, baby drill part, sounds catchy, but what you're implying is that the reality will be that it's not going to be or make such a difference to U.S. energy policy. Is that right?
Yes, that's what I think. So essentially, what's very interesting is when you look at oil production, for example, it has actually boomed more under Biden than under the first presidency of Donald Trump. So you already see that the correlation or the importance of the administration for oil production is relatively limited. Oil production and oil prices, they're dictated by global growth, global demand, etc. So I think it shouldn't be overstated the impact that the presidency can have on oil production. This being said, I think at the margin, it certainly is going to benefit domestic oil producers that will have less regulatory constraints. So, you know, I also don't want to say it has no effect. I think, weakening those climate policies will slow down a bit the transition. It will lead to aggravated economic costs, etc. So it's not nothing, but shouldn't be overstated.
So what do you think the first policy shifts, changes will be that we need to focus on? And I mean, do you see a lot of the kind of the tax credits, the tax benefits shifting from renewables to fossil fuels? Or do you think it's just more a case of maybe not so many going down the avenue of the renewable route?
Yeah, so I think the most likely first policy will be a repealing of the EV tax credits. Donald Trump hasn't made it a secret. He doesn't really believe in EVs, so I think it's going to be the first thing happening. There's another.
Apparently, one of his close advisors might believe a little bit more in EVs. What does Mr. Musk think about all of this?
Yeah, actually, the way I see it is actually Tesla is benefiting from this EV tax credits, but they're actually more in advance than other EV car producers. So on a relative basis, they don't benefit as much from these EV tax credits. So I think actually Musk wouldn't be so much against removing them.
So actually they're in a better position without them than the competition. Therefore, he's not putting up too much resistance.
Yes, okay, yes, exactly.
Very good.
Yeah. Another thing that I wanted to mention is around, which is funnily enough related to Tesla, is this Loan Programs Office, which is acting as a big source of capital from the federal government for emerging sources of technology of energy that need financing and that are in the early stage. And this program actually has benefited Tesla, has essentially saved it from bankruptcy a few years ago. And now this is under threat of being repealed. So I think this would be a negative for the U.S. In particular, when you think about it in an international dimension, with the competition with China, which is pretty insane how much lead they have in a number of clean technologies, and essentially removing this loan programs office in the U.S. could prove to be detrimental to clean energy, clean innovation in the U.S. And it could turn out actually to be a strategic mistake for you.
I mean, that's a really important point, because to me, we're at this kind of, I guess, fork in the road, in that China has committed so much resources, so much to clean energy. And of course, now they're being accused of dumping all of this on the global stage. The argument in many parts of the world has been, well, we're anti-dumping because it impacts our local market, our local companies. Tying this together then, what do we see in the United States? Is it a case of, well, these local companies aren't doing this anyway? Or even if that's the case, given the fact that we're going to have a shifting loan availability, tax credits, that they're going to be naturally, impacted by policy. I guess what I'm getting at is, has China won this one? Has China won the renewable space? And actually, is the U.S. ever going to be, or do you think there's ever a desire to play any sort of catch-up?
Yeah, so it's a very interesting one, and I think a very, very important one. So what an optimistic twist on this tariffs discussion, etc., essentially taxing more clean energy exports from China. The optimistic twist would be, okay, we do this. We do this to protect our domestic industry so that we can have our own sources of EVs or solar panels, batteries is very important as well. So that would be the optimistic twist, which is buy a bit of time so that we can compete and not being obliterated by the cheap Chinese exports. Now, will this be the case in the US? It's an open question. I think this is also where the states will play a big role, because it seems the federal government will have less of a say in those initiatives. So the response at the state level will be critical. There's already some evidence that certain states such as California are trying to, if the federal government moves away, they will try to replace it, basically. Mm. So there's some response at the state level. Another thing which in another region of the world is really what's happening in Europe, and also with those tariffs. I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see how they balance their objectives in terms of, you know, achieving net zero. They have very ambitious climate objectives. So they need renewables, they need batteries, they need all of the things that China is actually producing. But at the same time, they're, you know, a strategic rivalry. There's a bit, some doubts about China and tariffs. So it's going to be difficult to achieve their objectives without China. So it's going to be interesting to see.
In Europe, Europe's already producing more electricity from renewables than fossil fuels. That track, is that now so established that's it's going to continue? Or given what you said about the tariff side, could you ever see, or could you see in the next year or two, that actually reversing again?
Yeah, so it's also very, very interesting. You know, Europe is a big fossil fuel importer. So they don't have the capacity, or they don't have the reserves of fossil fuel domestically. So they essentially, renewables for them is a way to reduce their dependence on other, you know, suppliers. So they have, in my view, a strategic interest in developing those renewables. Also, nuclear certainly is part of the energy mix, etc. So they have a big strategic advantage in developing those technologies. Which is, by the way, also holding for China. China is the largest fossil fuel exporter in the world, and it's also the country which is booming in terms of its clean energy. So I think the two are related. Over a relatively long horizon, there's a clear economic advantage in building those renewables, and in particular, given that what's happening with solar, for example, is really remarkable. The reduction in costs over the past few years, over the past decade, has been nothing short of remarkable. And it really shows that solar is becoming a cost-efficient way of producing energy. There are also issues with, you know, solar is an intermittent source of energy, so, you know, there are challenges down the road, but it's really remarkable.
But it seems we can no longer use the uneconomic argument against renewables, or even the subsidies that had been levied against them in the past. When I think about, and I was speaking to some of our colleagues in Asia, and they were telling me about, for example, the air quality in Beijing now is incredible. You can see across the streets. You know, I saw in Hong Kong, as an example, that there is air quality improvement. Now, of course, China still has a lot to do in terms of renewables. Of course, still heavily dependent on fossil fuels. But when we think about an economy like India, you know, so vibrant, high growth economy, very strong demographics that are only increasing. Where does India now fit into this? And is that an area that you're as optimistic about?
Yeah, so I think the case of India is very interesting also because they are, you know, a very large country, obviously. They have pretty high emissions. They're also growing, so those emissions are set to increase. Currently, they're still relying a lot on coal for their economic activity and for their energy. But they have very ambitious plans on developing solar energy in particular and other types of energy as well. And actually, it's very interesting because initially, They fell short on their pledges. They didn't deploy enough solar power compared to what they targeted. But in recent years, there's been a remarkable shift in that, and now they're really on track actually to reach their objectives in terms of solar deployment and solar energy generation. So it also shows, you know, they have all this coal domestically, which is very cheap, but they also have solar, and it turns out that solar is actually competitive from a cost perspective. So that's also here a positive story, but there are challenges. Sure.
Maybe let's just take this economic argument a little bit further. I mean, you spoke earlier about the accuracy of climate models. You've done a massive amount of work here at Zurich and on climate modeling. Thinking about it from a macroeconomic perspective, how do you see the various flight paths of transitioning and the impact that's going to have on global growth? Can you give us some idea of the true impact that both a faster transition and a slower transition, what does that mean from an economic perspective?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question as well. So essentially, it depends on the path that we're taking. Obviously, there's those climate scenarios. At one end of the spectrum, you have the current policy scenario, is usually called, is the one where we essentially don't do much and we just let physical risk accumulate, and it leads to disasters and lots of issues down the road. Well, this one will most likely be the one with the greatest economic damages in terms of GDP and also inflation. What we can expect in a world which is warming at a very high pace is, you know, losses of productivity in terms of labor, also agricultural yield, etc. So that would push up prices, in particular commodities. At the same time, there's going to be friction, and also growth will decrease. Now, on the other end of the spectrum is this really ambitious net zero by 2050, which, you know, appears a bit unlikely given the path that we're heading. But in this scenario, it would be a bit more disruptive in the short term, but for longer term gains. So there's this intertemporal you know, characteristic of this scenario, which is very important. But essentially, in the net zero scenario, where we transition quite fast into renewable energy, etc., we can expect in the short term higher energy prices because, you know, there's some things that we're currently doing with fossil fuel where it's not economical to do with renewables because of the technology. Maybe in a few years that will be different, but currently. So that would push up prices. There's also relocation of resources that would happen that would essentially act as a negative supply shock. But the longer term effects of this transition would be smaller than the scenario where we don't do anything.
Effectively, you're saying we need a bit of short-term pain, meaning that maybe a little bit weaker growth, maybe a little bit higher inflation, which is frankly hard to sell to people given where we come from recently with inflation. Yep. But that's needed in order to ultimately get to a place where actually the growth dynamic could be improved actually by this transition.
Yes, so that's basically the argument. I think this is relatively unlikely precisely because of the reasons that you've mentioned. But from a longer term societal welfare perspective, that would be the optimal path. Now there's the reality, it's going to be different. But a point that I want to emphasize is in a world where we have more renewables, we have those new sources of energy, which I think are essentially superior forms of energy, the marginal cost of energy becomes very small. So essentially, once you've installed solar panels, once you have the batteries and all the things needed for more renewables, the cost of energy really becomes marginally zero, which is, you know, given that energy really is at the root of any type of economic activity, that would act as a very powerful productivity enhancer and ultimately lead to more economic output more efficiently. So the longer term case, it's pretty compelling.
Always being an optimist, I was always encouraged by the fact that, to me, it was always in companies' interests to make the transition and make a transition rapidly to gain a competitive advantage, which would make their products arguably more attractive to a consumer base that certainly seemed to be moving in the direction of wanting companies to be responsible. Having said that, you know, when I look at corporate releases recently, it seems that there is a bit of a pushback. Well, maybe not pushback, but a delay in some of the commitments that these companies indeed are making. Should I be more concerned? Was this inevitable? Were some of these targets just simply unrealistic, but it doesn't really change the direction of travel?
Yeah, very valid question. So what we've seen also recently is this Net Zero Alliance for Banking in the US, mm-hmm. where a lot, several banks have decided to walk away from that. I think this is a very US-centric phenomenon. And I think one of the reasons for this is that climate actually has become a partisan issue in the US. It's almost woke to talk about climate. So there certainly what I see happening is potentially a reframing of this climate issues into more energy related discussions. It's about also energy security, energy independence. So I think a reframing of those discussions could be helpful, particularly in the US. And I think another trend which is related to that is what's happening on the geopolitical front with, you know, we all know it is fragmentation. And in such an environment, having secure and reliable energy systems is becoming increasingly important. And I think ultimately, if we recognize the advantage of actually decentralized sources of energy, such as renewables, etc., that could actually give some additional momentum to that. But yeah, there's some issues.
And just maybe just on that, so the political element to this, you know, you're looking at the title of your paper, you know, will the green energy transition survive a Mr. Trump? The answer sounds like yes, if I'm kind of rapidly paraphrasing your paper. But maybe just on that, what do you think the net consequence is? Is it just that the US loses the kind of leadership? Could that mean that other countries follow the US in maybe being less forceful in their move to energy transition? What is the key, when we look back in 4 years' time, what do you think that the legacy of the Trump administration will be?
Yeah. So to make it clear, I think this, we're losing time. With all these discussions, we're losing time, and that's bad because that means that climate change is increasing and is going to have larger effects. Another point which I think is extremely important is around carbon pricing, global carbon prices. And essentially, climate change is a global problem, it's a global challenge, so we need global response to it. I think from being an economist, to me, the most efficient way to address it is through a global price of carbon, because climate change arises because of an externality. So there is a market failure. The price of pollution is just too low. It should be higher. And changing the price is an incredibly powerful message to align incentives. So we need a price of carbon. This price of carbon needs to be global so that we can really tackle climate change efficiently and rapidly, really. But on that front, this looks, prior to the election of Donald Trump, the prospect of reaching a global price of carbon was already quite low.
We've been saying at Zurich for, I think, at least 10 years,
yeah,
we need a global price. We need to price these externalities. We need to allow market forces to shift the narrative. 10 years plus later, we're still debating this here today. Have we really moved on at all, even prior to the Trump election victory?
Yeah, so I think increasingly there, you know, it's kind of a potential snowball effect, right? Mm. Now, if you introduce a carbon price, it doesn't hurt you as much as maybe it used to, because you have the alternatives, right? Maybe 10 years ago, renewables were not at the levels that they are today. So the alternatives wasn't very clear. Now, I think and it's also related to technological change, technological innovation. Alternatives exist. There are ways to reduce your emissions, and that wouldn't be too costly. So on that front, because the economic case is increasingly convincing, that makes the price of the economy cost of a carbon price less. But I would agree with you. This is frustrating. There's not enough progress on these questions, and in particular now with Donald Trump has essentially pledged to go out of the Paris agreements, this international climate talks. And that could create a cascading effect for other countries to follow through. If, the U.S. is not even part of the discussion, has no leadership in those discussions.
Why do we need to follow?
Why would we need to follow? Yeah. But I think also a lot of countries in Southeast Asia, for example, they are seeing physical climate change first, very closely. And they also understand the need of addressing it.
Well, I think one of the many interesting facts or factoids in your paper that really struck me was the fact that it looks like what $2 trillion is going to be or have been spent in 2024 on clean energy, clean investment. Now, that's more than fossil fuels. So I guess you could say, well, the money is flowing. The money is being deployed. Despite the political or the narrative, investments are being made. And one assumes that that's likely to be the case also in 2025.
Yes, absolutely. I think the trend is very clear. Clean energy investments really increasing massively. It's actually mostly driven by China, which is essentially accounting a third of this clean energy investment. So yes, clearly there's lots of clean energy investment. It's also generating growth. And I think the numbers were essentially 10% of real GDP growth in China was driven by those clean energy investments. So, there's good momentum. This is going to increase. The ratio of investment to clean energy versus fossil fuel is 2-1. So essentially for every dollar we spend on fossil fuel, we spend twice this amount on clean energy. And I expect this ratio to increase as well.
What do you think the big breakthrough really has to be in terms of clean energy? Will it be about storing power? Because the argument is always, well, what happens when the sun doesn't shine or the waves don't rise? Is that going to be the breakthrough moment that we need to see really to make this absolutely safeguarded?
Yes, absolutely. That's precisely that. Essentially, when you start installing renewables, it's relatively easy because you don't have to power the whole system with renewables. When you reach a certain threshold, you need to store this energy, so you need a storage capacity. I think there's been a lot of progress in batteries. Actually, the energy density of battery cells has massively increased in recent years, so this is very positive. But we need to scale up storage capacities. I think the big wild card is with hydrogen. So hydrogen has struggled quite a bit in recent years. Yeah. Now, if we manage to do this in a cost-effective way, that could also be a great solution for storage. But questions around storage certainly should be a priority.
So maybe rounding this up, Brendan, because again, I would encourage all our listeners to read the paper, some very good arguments and facts in that. But, you again do sound optimistic. I need to be optimistic. What do you think 25 has in store then? Do you think there will be any breakthroughs? Do you think there will be countries preparing to stick their neck out and be more forward-looking in terms of their policies or their approach? How do you see that the coming year?
Yeah, so I think 2025 will certainly be a period of transition in terms of all those things, because in 2026 there's the carbon border adjustment mechanism that's happening in Europe, and we already see some countries preparing to it and linking or talking about linking their carbon market with that of Europe. So I think this is going to be a very important theme. Obviously, the stance of Trump on those questions will be very interesting to follow. And as we said in the beginning, the Republican states have benefited from this clean energy investment, and they may increase as well. So we'll have to follow this very, very closely. And of course, this is all of this is happening in a geopolitical environment. So what's happening on the geopolitical front will also be key for what happens in the energy transition.
Very good. Well, that's a good uplifting note to leave it on. I know that you will or are working on the carbon border tax in Europe. I think that will be fascinating to see how that gets implemented and the outcome of that is. In the meantime, we keep hoping that we somehow find a breakthrough to a global carbon price. But in the meantime, thank you very much, Brendan. Again, to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'll have another podcast coming up very shortly. Thank you again.